You know, most of us get it that the U.S. government failed to fix the banking system after the economic meltdown back in 2008. But here's the rub. The world of high-end finance and wealth creation, not making new products or building factories, is ruling the country. Our guest today says it's the tail wagging the dog, and our financial system is just as vulnerable as ever. The fortunes of companies are on the rise, but not those of the average American who's seeing flat wage growth and a proliferation of $15 an hour jobs. The threat to America isn't coming from immigration or China, but perhaps from inside our borders. Our guest today is Rana Faruhar. She's an assistant managing editor at Time and the magazine's economics columnist. She also speaks regularly on CNN as a global economics analyst. She's the author of a provocative new book, Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. And Rana, so nice to have you. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You say point blank that we are on a collision course for another cataclysmic economic meltdown. Why are you so sure?
Well, basically, the core problem that created the financial crisis of 2008 has not been fixed. And in my mind, that's the fact that the financial markets have become an end in and of themselves rather than a support for real business. So the killer stat in my book is that only 15% of the money that is washing around U.S. financial institutions today makes its way into mainstream, Main Street businesses. And if you step back for a minute and think about how capitalism is supposed to work, how Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism, actually set it up, it was supposed to take our savings, consumer savings, worker savings, we put it in the bank, and those banks are supposed to lend money to real businesses. That's how it works. That's how, you know, growth and prosperity and job creation happens. But today, only 15% of the money in the financial system is doing that. And, you know, the rest of it is existing in this closed loop of trading, the bidding up of assets, stocks, bonds, houses. And as this has happened, this has been a process that has been created over the last 40 years, the number of financial crises has increased and our system has become more vulnerable, and it remains that way.
You know, that's just really scary stuff. I mean, 2008 wasn't that long ago. There are still, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people in this country suffering from what happened as a result of that meltdown just a few years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I feel my book is so urgent. And in fact, I think it goes a long way towards explaining the current political situation that we're in right now, where you have candidates on the far right and on the far left really gaining so much traction unexpectedly. And Hillary Clinton, a more moderate candidate, having trouble getting as much traction as many people thought she would at this stage.
You know, people wonder the obvious question. We can't fix the problem. We won't fix the problem. Why? Why is this so difficult given what the country's been through?
Well, you have to step back and look at how powerful the financial industry is. So, you know, you think about 2008, you think the big banks, well, you know, many of them folded, but actually the largest institutions are larger and more powerful than they were before the crisis. And the industry itself, over the last 40 years, has about doubled in size. So the U.S. Wow. financial industry, just to give you a sense of its scope and power, it represents about 7% of the economy. It creates only 4% of jobs, but it takes about 25% of all corporate profits. So think about that. That is such a disproportionate amount of economic oxygen that is being taken out of the room. And a lot of academic research shows that as when finance gets even half that size, it starts to really slow growth. And I'll just say one more thing, which is that the financial industry, understandably, given its size and scope and wealth, has a tremendous amount of power in Washington. So if you look in this political season, six out of the top 10 biggest donors to political candidates are hedge fund managers.
Wow. Rana, I'm going into my Memorial Day weekend. I want to be relaxed and chilled out. And you're scared.
So sorry.
Me
I've got some good news at the end of the book. Get the book and read chapter 11.
Okay. There's something to hang on to. You've already alluded to this, but you haven't used this word yet. You toss around this new word at readers in this book. It's financialization. And you write about it this way. It's a term for the trend by which Wall Street and its way of thinking have come to reign supreme in America, permeating not just the financial industry, but all American business. So what do you mean when you say Wall Street and its way of thinking?
Well, two things, really. Wall Street practices, the way that the financial industry works, has become a model for the rest of American business. So if you actually look at airlines, for example, many of them now get more money hedging oil prices and being traders in the commodities markets than they do selling coach seats. You have GE only recently not being a too-big-to-fail bank and selling off financial services. You have big tech companies underwriting corporate bond offerings the way Goldman Sachs does. So it's amazing. This is across every industry, and business in general gets about five times as much revenue from just moving money around than it used to 40 years ago.
God, that's just amazing. And your opening anecdote to the book is about Apple, and just very much to the point you just made, that Apple is spending less on research and development and doing a whole lot more when it comes to finding ways to drive up its stock price, at least in the short term, right?
Yeah, this tends to happen, you know, when a company moves away from, I would say, its core mission of innovation and towards financialization, they start to look for ways to artificially bolster the share price. And something that's happened in recent years, I would argue that Apple hasn't really had a huge technological breakthrough since Steve Jobs passed away in 2011. But what they do have is a lot of cash, because they're a very rich company. So they've got about $200 billion of cash sitting in bank accounts, many of them overseas and offshore tax havens. But they've been borrowing billions of dollars in the markets in recent years. Well, why are they borrowing? Not to create new factories or pay workers more or do R&D, but to pay back shareholders by buying up stock on the open market, which artificially jacks up the share price. And it pleases people like Carl Icahn, who's been tweeting for them to do that over the last several years before he actually dumped the stock recently. But all this is by way of saying that companies like Apple are now more involved in the capital markets at a time when they don't actually need any capital, you know, which just shows you how Kafkaesque the system is and how skewed it is towards enriching the top 10% of the population that owns 80% of all the stock.
There's Kafka, and then there's a guy named Karl Marx, who I think once said that a system based primarily on greed would eventually collapse, right?
Yes. Yeah. I know. It's funny. Marx has been trending on Google ever since the financial crisis, and it's easy to understand why. You know, I'm for capitalism. I think capitalism has enriched more people than any other system in the history of the world. But you have to make sure that capitalism works for everybody, or else you get the kind of polarized politics that we have now in this country and even more so in Europe. And that's what my book is all about. How can we really fix this system that has become broken over the last 40 years?
Rana Faruhar is my guest. Her new book, Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. I'm just guessing some of our listeners will want to call in and ask some questions here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So I guess this begins to explain what you're laying out here today, why the economic recovery has been so lackluster and ineffective for so many millions of Americans. You say it's, again, because the financial system has stopped serving the real economy and now serves mainly itself, right?
That's right. And, you know, this is something, again, it's happened over a long period of time, and it's a very bipartisan thing. You know, we a lot of times point the finger at the bankers, and certainly many of them deserve blame for what happened in 2008. But actually, the changes that enabled finance to grow to a point where it's choking off the rest of the economy were taken by both Republican and Democratic administrations over the last 40 years. It's been a series of small changes. And, you know, even now, we are in this period, for example, where since 2008, we had gridlock in Congress, so we couldn't have a real fiscal reform program, federal fiscal program that would really help businesses grow at a grassroots level. We had this kind of sugar high of easy money. The Fed parachuted in and put $4 trillion of money in the economy. You know, they had no choice, by the way. They were the only men, and now with Janet Yellen, only woman standing to do something. So I'm not blaming them. But what I am saying is that kind of easy money is just a Band-Aid over a problem that can really only be fixed by fiscal stimulus and real business investment.
So to what extent do money people out there, are they taking advantage of ordinary Americans? Because, you know, this economic stuff tends to confuse people pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that you can look at, as a business gets bigger, it should become more cost efficient, right? So you think about a company like Walmart. I mean, you may or may not like Walmart, but one thing they do offer is low prices, and they can offer that because they're large. Well, the financial industry seems to exist in this zero gravity world where the same, you know, laws don't apply, because as it's gotten bigger, fees have actually gotten higher. You know, Americans are paying double what they did in terms of bank fees in the 1980s. And many parts of the industry, like, for example, asset management, you know, the group of the part of the industry that manages our retirement funds, our 401ks, many of these funds charge huge fees. In fact, Jack Bogle, who was one of the financiers who did an interview for my book, he's the head of Vanguard Funds, which is an index fund company. He estimates that actively managed funds actually eat up between 30% and 60% of people's retirement nest egg. And a lot of academic research has shown this as well. So,
30% to 60%?
Yeah, of the retirement returns are eaten up by fees, because what happens is these actively managed fees rarely, if ever, outperform the market, and yet many of our companies are invested in them. And this goes actually to a broader point, which is that my book is about more than banks and too big to fail banks and what happened in 2008. It's about a whole ecosystem, including our retirement system, housing policy, the structure of our tax policy, that is supporting the financial system, but not supporting Main Street.
Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Vicki from Weatherby Lake on the Missouri side. Vicki, you're on with Rana Faruhar. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Rana, I was hoping you could explain something about credit default swaps. My understanding is that they contributed to the crash in 2008. And the reason I'm interested is that I was one of the unfortunate buyers of Lehman Brothers bonds.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
That were rated A and suddenly went bankrupt. And my understanding is that credit default swaps played a large role in this.
Ron, explain what credit default swaps are before you get rolling here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, credit default swaps are what Warren Buffett called weapons of mass financial destruction. which is as good an explanation as I've ever heard. They basically are an artificially created financial product that splices and dices together a lot of different kinds of assets. Some of them might be those loans you talked about with Lehman Brothers. Sometimes you have credit default swaps that include just one kind of asset. Sometimes they've got like Frankenstein's monster. You know, they might have tens or even hundreds of different assets as part of this single security that traders can then buy and sell. What's interesting is this whole product, the area of the financial market, got started because it was supposed to offer insurance against existing assets, you know, the way a farmer might take, say, a hedge on the price of his corn. You know, in that sense, they can be useful, but like so many aspects of the financial market, they've grown like Topsy, and they've been concocted in such a way now that they really, not only do they not offer protection, oftentimes they offer a lot of risk, unless you're a very sophisticated trader who knows how to deal with these products in split-second increments. So I would argue, and it's funny, the CDO, as they call it, the acronym is CDO, the CDO market is so many times bigger than the underlying product that is being securitized. That is a really good way of seeing that actually the market is so disconnected from Main Street. I mean, you don't need to insure your house 1,000 times against its value, yet you have a CDO market that is many, many times what's actually being insured.
Vicki, I hope that helps. Let me go to Imani from Kansas City, Missouri. Imani, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you so much for taking my call. A lot of the economic reporters and writers were criticized for not reporting what they saw in the markets that may have led to the last financial crisis, with the exception of Michael Smith that wrote Moneyball and Gretchen Morgenstern. What do you see as being the next financial crisis based on what you're seeing in the markets?
That's such a great question. You know, I want to actually, I'll answer that, but I want to speak to the first statement you
Please,
made, which is
yeah.
very true, that journalists really missed this. And it's interesting. I used to work with Gretchen Morgenson at Forbes. I think she's an amazing reporter. She's at the Times now. Michael Lewis, also a banker who had retired from banking, had an interesting perspective on the crisis. I think, and I cover this in my book, I think one of the reasons that so many people miss the crises is because there's what's called cognitive capture, not only of policymakers, but of journalists, that we have all come to believe the hype of finance. Many of the journalists that cover the industry, you know, they have to go back again and again and again to bankers as sources. And so sometimes you can't really, you know, write a lot of terrible stories, or you'll lose your sources, or you come to believe what they're saying, and maybe you're not doing the legwork and investigating all that you should be. I think that there was a lot of that prior to the crisis. But to answer your second question of where I see risk in the market right now, I actually see it in what's called the shadow banking sector. So the Dodd-Frank financial regulations have meant that some risk has gone down in the formal banking sector. But that risk has flowed. It's kind of like water. You know, it looks for all the cracks. Mm-hmm. And it's flowed into the places like hedge funds, private equity funds, the corporate bond market, areas that are a little less regulated. I actually think that we've already seen a bubble in corporate bonds. You see a lot of defaults in mining companies and energy companies and manufacturing companies that are related to those recently. You saw Exxon being downgraded. So I think watching the corporate bond market, and in particular the corporate junk bond market, is an important thing right now.
So you would change the system how, Ronnie, if you could wave a magic wand here? What would you do to fix it?
Well, there are practical solutions, and then there are kind of existential solutions. So let me start with the latter, which is, and I think it's a good starting point. We need to change the narrative. We have come, and all of us really have come to believe over the last four decades that finance is the tippy top of the economic pyramid. You know, it's what we graduate to after we go from being an agrarian society to a manufacturing economy to a services economy. That finance is at the top, and we should all sort of aspire to be there as a country. And I would say, let's flip that triangle and put it on its head. Finance is just supposed to serve all those other industries and businesses, you know, and right now the paradigm has shifted. So we need to shift it back. So that's point number one. Point number two is, even though there's not one silver bullet, because remember, it's been 40 years of small policy changes that have gotten us here, there is some low-hanging fruit that we can start plucking. And I think one area that's ripe for plucking is the tax code. The American tax code favors debt over equity and savings. And it's just a really perverse thing. You know, we incentivize companies and consumers to take on more debt than they really should, and then we allow people to write that off on their taxes. Instead, let's incentivize investment. Let's incentivize savings.
That sounds so simple. Why hasn't Congress already done that already? That makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, no, it has. Unfortunately, you're fighting a tidal wave of special interests. You know, finance, debt is the lifeblood of finance. Debt is where finance makes money. And so bankers and the financial industry have done just about everything they can. They've spent billions and billions of dollars lobbying against the closing of loopholes and the changes in the tax code that would prevent them from making money in that way. And it's something that we really, really need to take a stand against.
Well, Ronnie, you are just a AAA rated guest. I just really enjoyed having you. Just terrific. Ronnie Faruhar is the assistant managing editor at Time, the magazine's economics columnist. Her provocative new book, Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. Terrific interview, Ronnie. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you for having me.
Time for a break. When we come back here, we'll talk with the poet laureate of the United States. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR.